morning, everybody. It is wonderful to see all of you here this morning, and really good to be with you all. It's been a fantastic week. I know for Madeline and I, at least, we've really enjoyed the nice, cool weather and being able to sit outside and enjoy, you know, the scenery and everything like that. And getting up this morning and walking to the car was a pleasant experience for this like 1 week of fall that we get every year. We're grateful for it. So. And I hope you all are as well. Our God in the Nightmare, our God in the Nightmare is our title for this morning. If you were with us last week, you know that we are working through the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel. It's one of my favorite books of the Bible. The stories that we find in it are so dynamic and so, the characters that we find in it are so honest. And I'm excited for this study that we have this morning. And if you have ever read Daniel chapter 2, you know that technically what we have here is a dream, and not actually maybe a nightmare, but I chose Our God in the Nightmare to be a maybe a title that would catch your attention so that we'd all be kind of clued in and everything like that. You know, so I hope you're on the edge of your seat, just ready to figure out what this is going to be about. I'm excited for it. I hope you are as well. Let's begin here in Daniel chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. I'm going to read just a little bit for us and then kind of give us an idea of what we can expect from this morning. And we'll just kind of walk through Daniel chapter 2. We aren't going to read the whole thing by any means. We're just going to bounce through it and look at a couple points here. And I was reminded this morning by Josh Brumfield as well that the greatest sermon ever preached by Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount, was 14 minutes. So I'll be doing some condensing maybe. Hopefully, we'll see. Daniel chapter 2, let's begin in verse 1 here. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. That's where we'll begin this morning. So first of all, what we're going to look at today is Nebuchadnezzar's dream, his desire, and Daniel's mission. And today we'll be talking about truth. As you know, our study in Daniel has really been about how to live as a Christian, as a person of faith, in a world in which we don't really belong, in a world of great pride, in a world of power, in a world that is often hostile to our faith. And last week what we talked about, what we began to talk about, was how to draw lines and boundaries, right? Because we know that the answer to how to live in our world as a Christian isn't to enter our world and then to just accept everything that we see, to live as the people around us live, right, and to completely lose our Christian identity. We know that isn't the answer. But we also know that the answer isn't just to, like, lock the doors and to, you know, like, start farming out here in this, like, field and create a little compound and, like, keep all of us in here. You know, doing the Christian sort of thing and living out the Christian identity just here and never going out into our world. And so you may have been dissatisfied last week as we looked through Daniel 1 and found that the answer to where we draw boundaries isn't always clear, right? That it requires wisdom, that there isn't a straightforward answer for a lot of the questions that we have surrounding where to draw these boundaries and these lines concerning how we interact with our world, but that it's something that requires us to use our mind and to use our wisdom to approach that. And this morning, what we're going to be talking about is truth. Proclaiming truth in our world, living out truth in the various places that we find ourselves, in the various situations we find ourselves, a truth that's difficult, but a truth that people need to hear. How do we do that? And so this morning, we begin with Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Nebuchadnezzar, we're told, he's the king in Babylon. And at some point in his life, he starts having dreams. And it doesn't tell us what this dream is. at the beginning of chapter 2, but we learn what it is. We have this very helpful old school picture of this dream. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and in his dream, you'll know if, after reading the end of chapter 2, he sees a great statue, an enormous statue. Presumably, it's a statue of him. And its head is made of gold, and its body is made of silver, and its thighs, its waist area is made of bronze. Its legs are iron, but its feet are iron mixed with clay. And in this dream that Nebuchadnezzar has, this great king, this statue, that is presumably a statue of him, is standing, it's dwarfing everything, and its presence is enormous, and he's feeling comfortable. But then all of a sudden, and if you look down here in chapter 2, beginning in verse 35. Then the iron, the clay, and the bronze, and silver, and gold all together were broken in pieces. Right? Verse 34. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image, and its feet of iron and clay, and broke them in pieces. And then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold, all together were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So we know that as he's looking at this image, that presumably is an image of himself, he sees a stone that is described as it's a stone cut out by no human hand, and it strikes the image and destroys everything. And so as we read in the beginning of chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar is very concerned about this dream. He's losing sleep about it. He wakes up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, right? And you've probably had these dreams before. And after a couple nights of doing this and having this sort of reoccurring dream, he finds that he can't sleep at all. He's concerned about this. It weighs on his heart at all times. And what is this dream? When we look at Nebuchadnezzar's dream, I think we see something universal. How we typically talk about chapter 2 is we like to get into like the prophecies about what each section of each part of the statue means and the kingdoms that will arise and everything like that. And that's all well and good. But what I want to point our attention to is just the universal sort of humanity of this dream that he has here. He sees himself in the statue, and he sees his greatness. It's big, right? This is something that's going to last forever, right? He sees a head of gold that's magnificent, a chest of silver, right? But deep down, Nebuchadnezzar has a fear, and it's that his feet are not made of iron, but they're made of iron and clay. And that eventually something will come along, some sort of circumstance, right? A rock cut by no human hands, and it will come and it will destroy the statue, everything that he's worked for, everything that he's built. And even though he has this image of himself, how he'd want himself to be, this sort of like great, everlasting, strong, eternal figure, he fears that the deep down, his feet are made of clay, and something will come along to destroy him. And that those pieces that get destroyed will then sort of like blow away in the wind like chaff, right? And he'll be no more. In this statue, this thing that he's built, this kingdom that he's built, it won't make it even to its next generation, and he'll be forgotten. I think that's why he stays up, right, at night. This is a concerning dream to have if you're a king, right, that you have a statue that gets blown away. And I think the fear that is sort of implicit in this dream is a fear that's sort of universal. It's a fear that all of us share. And I want to give you another example of this. I don't know if you can see this very well. This is one of my favorite paintings. I like showing you paintings every once in a while. This is one of my favorite paintings. This is at the The Museum of Art in Indianapolis. If you've never heard of it, it's because it's a very small art museum. But they have this painting, and the reason why this is one of my favorite paintings is I looked at this for like 10 or 15 minutes. It just like really struck me. It's one of the first paintings in my life that I feel like I really understood, and I'll tell you why. All right, I think I have a laser pointer here. Oh boy, here we go. So here in the middle, we have this scene, and this is a right here. This is a Civil War officer, right? He's a young man, and he's a Civil War officer, and he's about to go off to war, right? And he doesn't know what he's about to face, but he knows that he's about to, you know, about to go to war, and it's going to be maybe exciting and adventurous, but probably, as we know, destructive and painful and horrible. But before he goes off to war, he has this quiet moment, this silent moment in this drawing room type area with his loved one. And before he goes off, you can see here she's kissing his sword as sort of a goodbye, a consecration. This is called the consecration, I believe, by George Cochran Lambdon. And they're sharing this quiet little moment before the like disaster that will become, you know, this war. And what I love about this picture is that as you look at it, this is such a quiet and serene moment. It's a moment of peace, right, that's being depicted here. But what I love about paintings is that this isn't a picture. And because it's not a photograph, it means that everything in this picture, right, everything in this painting, somebody took hours painstakingly adding, right? Which means that everything in this painting has a purpose. And you can't see it very well, but they have this quiet, serene moment, and then you have this figure right here, and you, man, you just can't see it hardly at all, but it's a bust right here, and I encourage you to look at this painting, maybe in your free time when you, you know, want to. But there's this bust right here. It's a very dark figure, and it's sort of looming around the corner, right? And it has no reason to be there, but it is. It's up on the corner, and it's a dark figure, and it's sort of just around the corner. And you get the sense that in this quiet, serene moment, that just around the corner, there's looming something dark and horrible, right? And in this case, it's the Civil War, right? That they have a quiet moment to share together, a moment of peace, but just around the corner, tragedy will come, right? It's a beautiful painting, in my opinion. I love it. I think it's great. And the reason why I think it's great is because this is how I feel a lot of the time, right? That I have good and great peaceful stretches of my life, but I'm constantly worried about this dark, looming figure that's maybe just around the bend, right? I'm constantly worried about this rock cut from no human hand that will come and destroy everything that I've worked for, right? This is a human concern. And for Nebuchadnezzar, as he has this dream of his statue that will be destroyed, what's being displayed here is a concern that all of us have. It's a universal concern. And one thing that I think this story teaches us and tells us is that underneath, we'll go all the way back. Underneath every person is this sort of existential concern, maybe, that everybody is worried about this, right? Their statue, everything that they've worked for, and everything that they are being destroyed in a moment of time. Everybody's worried about this, right? And Nebuchadnezzar, he can't sleep, and he's very concerned. That's where we find him. That's his dream. That's his nightmare. But let's look at something else real quick, and that's Nebuchadnezzar's desire. Look at verse 4 of chapter 2. So he calls all of his the wise men, all of the enchanters together. And then the Chaldean said to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation." The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor." Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. And they said a second time, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show you its interpretation. And the king answered and said, I know for certain that you are just trying to buy time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. And so here we meet this character, Nebuchadnezzar, and he has this sort of underlying fear, this universal fear. But what's remarkable about Nebuchadnezzar is that we see here he wants to know the truth, right? He wants to know the truth. And in this scene, he tells them, he brings all of his prophets and his wise men and his interpreters and his sorcerers together. And this is sort of a regular thing that they talk about the dreams and everything. And he says, no, this time I want you to tell me the dream. Then I'll know for certain that you have the authority and the ability to tell me its interpretation. He's searching for truth. And what's significant about this that we don't really catch in Daniel, is that when he's making this decision, he's sort of breaking from a long line of tradition of Assyrian and Babylonian kings really just wanting to be told what they want to be told. So I'm currently writing my thesis, and in the process of doing that, I've had to read a lot of inscriptions of ancient Assyrian, like, sorcery and dream interpretation, which has been mostly horrible. It's just been a bad time. And, you know, there's this really fantastic inscription where there's this scribe from the Assyrian king Esarhaddon, and the scribe is writing in sort of his own personal journal that gets preserved for like 3,000 years. And in his journal he writes, the great king Esarhaddon has asked me to look in the sky and tell him anything that might involve his kingdom. But mostly I just tell him the good stuff. Right? And there's something so human about that. And kings are very explicit with their scribes even about really only interpreting the things that were good, right? And if you saw a certain configuration of stars that meant it was going to be bad for your kingdom, you want to sweep that under the rug, right? And just tell me the good stuff so we can move on, right? It became a sort of propaganda. But here, what we find is that Nebuchadnezzar, apart from his predecessors, he wants to know the truth. And I think this is significant because sometimes the people around us, as we enter our jobs, our family members, or whatever it is, the people around us, sometimes I think we don't give them enough credit. We believe that the people around us don't want to know the truth. Right? What we believe is the truth. Isn't that true? Sometimes we can be a bit weary about telling people around us what we believe to be the truth about how we should live our lives and what we should do, either because we don't believe they want to hear it, or, to quote Jack Nicholson, we don't believe they can handle the truth, right? They can't get it, yeah. But this isn't true, right? I really think we aren't giving the people around us enough credit. I think people want to know the truth. So a few years ago, you may not have known this about me, so I've been a religious studies major all 5 years of my undergrad, but I had a second major that sort of changed quite a lot. And there for a while, my second major was creative writing, and so I was a religious studies and creative writing double major, much to the displeasure of my parents, maybe, because it's not exactly practical, right? But so I was a creative writing major, and in creative writing, what you would do is you would show up in these classes and you'd write like a short story, and you'd show up and you'd trade short stories or whatever, and people would read yours, and then they would tell you, you know, what you needed to fix and everything. And one of the reasons why I just like dropped out of that major completely is I would write some really, really terrible, terrible stories. Like they were just not good, you know, because I'm just not a writer. And they were not great stories. And like looking back over them, I can read through and just see that they just weren't that great. But what do you think everybody told me as I gave them my stories? They're like, oh, Josh, this was great. You know, this is the best thing I've ever read, you know? And I don't know. It just like, okay, the problem with that is that then when you think you've written something really good and they tell you that you did a good job, you think like, oh, well, what do you know? Like, you thought that was good. You know what I mean? We need the truth, right? And we hunger for it, even if it hurts. Like, I want to know the truth, right? Because I want to be able to live my life in a way that's like consistent with reality, right? I want to know the truth. And maybe I'm just being optimistic, but I think the people around us that we work with and that we go to school with and the people that are in our families, I think they want to know the truth, right? Don't you? Even if it's difficult, and in whatever way that works out in your life and in your interactions with them, I think one important thing for us to keep in mind is that the people around us want to know the truth. They have a hunger for it. And it's a truth that stems from these sort of worries that we see displayed in Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar has this underlying worry, and he has a deep desire for the truth. And if you remember Proverbs 9 and verse 8, the latter half of that verse, correct a wise man and he will love you, right? People want to know the truth. I really believe that. The last thing here, Daniel's mission. We've looked at Nebuchadnezzar's dream and the underlying worries that sort of undergird his existence and maybe ours as well. That we all have this sort of fear within us that we're, you know, that the tragedy will strike and that everything that we've worked for will pass away. And we all have a desire for truth. And so how does he go about communicating this? Well, as we talked last week, one of the important things to note about Daniel is that Daniel here, because he has decided to like have an active role in his world, and because he's decided to draw boundaries that help make up his identity, he's reached the unique situation where he's the only person in Nebuchadnezzar's life that can tell him the truth. And he's cognizant of that. But the first thing that Daniel does, and it's notable, when he hears that the king is needing to have this dream interpreted and he's needed to be told the truth, the first thing that he does is he prays to God. Down in verse 17, Daniel went into his house and he made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. And Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And Daniel said, "Blessed be the name of our God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings, and gives wisdom to the wise, and knowledge to those who have understanding. And he reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God, my Father, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." And we know that down in verse 26, when he meets with the king asks him, "Are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen? And its interpretation," and Daniel answers the king in verse 27, "No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has, but there is a God who is in heaven, who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and your visions of your head as you lay in bed are these," and he continues with his interpretation. First of all, this is sort of a smaller point. Daniel is somebody who, in every facet of his life, he seeks to lift God up, right? He doesn't take credit for anything that he does. And he's constantly, to the people around him and to God himself, he's praising God for everything that he's done. And that speaks the truth of itself, I think. There's a great book by Fyodor Dostoevsky called The Brothers Karamazov. And in The Brothers Karamazov, you have three brothers, and they're sort of embroiled in this murder mystery surrounding their father's death. And it's a book about guilt, and it's a book about truth. And there's a character, one of the brothers, whose name is Ivan Karamazov. And Ivan is this great intellectual, right? And he has all of the arguments, right? And he's an atheist. And then you have his brother Alyosha, who's a monk. And he's a simple kind of man, and he he has great devotion, but he doesn't know the right thing to say at the right time, and he doesn't know all of the great arguments and everything like that. And time again, these two brothers, they have interactions, and they sort of butt heads a few times throughout the novel. And every time, Alyosha doesn't know the right thing to say. He doesn't have the right argument. He doesn't have any of that. And Ivan just sort of like drags him through the mud and puts him through the ringer and just tears him up intellectually. But in the end, you get the sense that just by Alyosha living out his life, right, that he's made an impact on Ivan and on the rest of the story. And you get the sense that in the end, that it was really Alyosha who was winning those arguments, not because he had the right thing to say and not because he had the best argument, but because he lived his life in a way that was consistent with reality, right? He lived his faith. And that's part of what Daniel does here. First, he goes to God. And when it comes to us proclaiming truth to our world, sometimes it will be saying the right thing at the right time. And sometimes it will be having a great argument or whatever, but sometimes it will just be, most times it will just be, living out our faith. And because of that, living in a way that's consistent with reality. And that's what he does here. And finally, when Daniel has this opportunity to speak the truth to King Nebuchadnezzar, he speaks the whole truth. He speaks the whole truth. Daniel's kind of put in a difficult situation here. Because Daniel has this truth from God. He knows the interpretation of the dream, but he knows that the interpretation of the dream isn't exactly positive, maybe, for Nebuchadnezzar. He knows that the interpretation of the dream will be that your kingdom will come to an end, and there'll be a kingdom after you, and a kingdom after that one, and a kingdom after that one, and eventually all of them will be destroyed and they'll be wiped away. And you don't want to tell that to a king, right? The king who is just willing to like put his servants to death for not even being able to like tell him the dream at all, right? This is Nebuchadnezzar that we're talking about. But first of all, when Daniel's put in a situation, he has the courage to tell Nebuchadnezzar the truth even when it's difficult and when it hurts. Even when the truth is oncoming and present destruction, he's willing to say that because he knows that's what Nebuchadnezzar is asked for. He's asked for the truth. But that's not where the truth ends, because he's telling the whole thing. And in the end, in this nightmare that Nebuchadnezzar has, there's hope. And let's read again verse 43. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will be mixed together with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. He's talking about this last kingdom. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end. It shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron and the bronze and the clay and the silver and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. Nebuchadnezzar has this underlying fear. It's kept him up at night. He's woken up in a cold sweat because of it. And his fear, the truth that maybe he knows deep down, but he's not sure, is that his kingdom will come to an end. It will be destroyed just like everything before him. And that eventually his memory will fade. Right? The memory of his existence will fade from the earth. He's dealing with this fear, and part of Daniel telling him the truth is to confirm that, but part of it is also to say, Nebuchadnezzar, one day, just like the rock that was cut with no human hands that became a mountain, God will establish a kingdom that will last forever. You can be a part of this kingdom. That this kingdom that's established, it will last forever. It will break every other kingdom. And it won't be like the chaff that is just sort of blown away with the wind. It'll stand. And if you want to be sort of caught up into this eternal kingdom, you can be. That's the message and the interpretation of the dream. It's the beauty of the truth that's in this dream. I'll end with this. Yesterday, Madeline and I were watching an old movie called The Great Dictator. Have any of you seen that, The Great Dictator? Charlie Chaplin? No? It's great. It's a great movie. The Great Dictator. It's sort of a comedy and a drama. It came out in 1940, but it's sort of a parody of Hitler and the Nazi Party, and it was prophetic in a lot of ways. But at the very end, you get this Jewish barber who is Charlie Chaplin, and he has been mistaken for the Great Dictator. And so, through a weird turn of events, this Jewish barber, who's not really anybody, has wound up on stage in front of like all of Austria and all of the world, because his speech is going to be broadcast to all of the world. And he's put in this unique situation to deliver this speech. And the entire movie, you know, it's been funny and everything, but then this really just, it's the final speech is just a gut punch. And it ends like this. He's speaking to a large crowd, but he's speaking specifically to a friend that he has, Hannah, who's been stepped on, who's been kicked and who's had everything taken from her, and he says, "Look up, Hannah. The clouds are lifting, the sun is breaking through. We are coming out of darkness and into the light. The soul of man has been given wings, and at last he is beginning to fly. He's flying into the light of hope, into the future, that glorious future that belongs to you, to me, and to all of us. Look up, Hannah. Look up." And I encourage you to go back and read or find that speech. It's fantastic. But this is the message of truth that we have to bring to our world. And so let's sort of wrap this up here. I think in this story, what we discover is a universal fear, not only that all of us share, but all people in our world share, that we're finite, right? Because we weren't meant to live in a world that was finite. We're eternal creatures, but we fear the opposite. We fear that everything that we are attached to will be taken away. This is the fear that sort of undergirds all of our lives. But we are also people who want the truth. And the people around us, the people that we see every day, want the truth. They want to see and hear the truth. And we can proclaim that truth by living it out and by proclaiming it in word. And when we do that, we should know that the message that we have to offer our world is not a message of pure destruction and fear, but it's a message of hope. That our God, in the midst of all that's finite in our world, is establishing a kingdom that's eternal. That's the hope that's embedded in our message of truth that we have to give the world. And I hope that we'll have the courage and the strength, that God will give us the courage and the strength to proclaim that in the way that we live and in our words with one another. And I pray that that He will encourage us all to join that kingdom. If you haven't joined that kingdom, we invite you to do so by putting Christ on in baptism, by coming while we stand and sing.